This is Audible.
Audible Modern Vanguard presents Less Than Zero by Bret Easton Ellis. Narrated by Christian Rummel.
People are afraid to merge on freeways in Los Angeles. This is the first thing I hear when I come back to the city. Blair picks me up from LAX and mutters this under her breath as her car drives up the on-ramp. She says, "People are afraid to merge on freeways in Los Angeles." Though that sentence shouldn't bother me, it stays in my mind for an uncomfortably long time. Nothing else seems to matter. Not the fact that I'm 18 and it's December and the ride on the plane had been rough and the couple from Santa Barbara, who were sitting across from me in first class, had gotten pretty drunk. Not the mud that had splattered the legs of my jeans, which felt kind of cold and loose, earlier that day at an airport in New Hampshire. Not the stain on the arm of the wrinkled, damp shirt I wear, a shirt which had looked fresh and clean this morning. Not the tear on the neck of my gray Argyle vest, which seems vaguely more Eastern than before, especially next to Blair's clean, tight jeans and her pale blue t-shirt. All of this seems irrelevant next to that one sentence. It seems easier to hear that people are afraid to merge rather than, "I'm pretty sure Muriel is anorexic," or the singer on the radio crying out about magnetic waves. Nothing else seems to matter to me but those 10 words. Not the warm winds, which seem to propel the car down the empty asphalt freeway, or the faded smell of marijuana which still faintly permeates Blair's car. All it comes down to is that I'm a boy coming home for a month and meeting someone whom I haven't seen for 4 months, and people are afraid to merge. Blair drives off the freeway and comes to a red light. A heavy gust of wind rocks the car for a moment, and Blair smiles and says something about maybe putting the top up and turns to a different radio station. Coming to my house, Blair has to stop the car since there are these 5 workmen lifting the remains of palm trees that have fallen during the winds and placing the leaves and pieces of dead bark in a big red truck, and Blair smiles again. She stops at my house and the gates open, and I get out of the car, surprised to feel how dry and hot it is. I stand there for a pretty long time, and Blair, after helping me lift the suitcases out of the trunk, grins at me and asks, "What's wrong?" And I say, "Nothing." And Blair says, "You look pale." And I shrug, and we say goodbye, and she gets into her car and drives away. Nobody's home. The air conditioner is on, and the house smells like pine. There's a note on the kitchen table that tells me that my mother and sisters are out, Christmas shopping. From where I'm standing, I can see the dog lying by the pool, breathing heavily, asleep, its fur ruffled by the wind. I walk upstairs, past the new maid, who smiles at me and seems to understand who I am, and past my sister's rooms, which still both look the same, only with different GQ cutouts pasted on the wall, and enter my room and see that it hasn't changed. The walls are still white, the records are still in place, the television hasn't been moved. The Venetian blinds are still open, just as I had left them. It looks like my mother and the new maid, or maybe the old maid, cleaned out my closet while I was gone. There's a pile of comic books on my desk with a note on top of them that reads, "Do you still want these?" Also, a message that Julian called, and a card that says, "Fuck Christmas," on it. I open it, and it says, "Let's fuck Christmas together," on the inside. An invitation to Blair's Christmas party. I put the card down and notice that it's beginning to get really cold in my room. I take my shoes off and lie on the bed and feel my brow to see if I have a fever. I think I do. And with my hand on my forehead, I look up with caution at the poster encased in glass that hangs on the wall above my bed, but it hasn't changed either. It's the promotional poster for an old Elvis Costello record. Elvis looks past me, with this wry, ironic smile on his lips, staring out the window. The word trust hovering over his head, and his sunglasses, one lens red, the other blue, pushed down past the ridge of his nose so that you can see his eyes, which are slightly off-center. The eyes don't look at me, though. They only look at whoever's standing by the window, but I'm too tired to get up and stand by the window. I pick up the phone and call Julian, amazed that I actually can remember his number. But there's no answer. I sit up, and through the Venetian blinds I can see the palm trees shaking wildly, actually bending in the hot winds. And then I stare back at the poster, and then turn away, and then look back again at the smile and the mocking eyes, the red and blue glasses. And I can still hear people are afraid to merge, and I try to get over the sentence, blank it out. I turn on MTV and tell myself I could get over it and go to sleep if I had some Valium. And then I think about Muriel and feel a little sick as the videos begin to flash by. I bring Daniel to Blair's party that night, and Daniel is wearing sunglasses and a black wool jacket and black jeans. He's also wearing black suede gloves because he cut himself badly on a piece of glass a week earlier in New Hampshire. I had gone with him to the emergency room at the hospital and had watched as they cleaned the wound and washed the blood off and started to sew in the wire until I started feeling sick, and then I went and sat in the waiting room at 5 o'clock in the morning and heard the Eagles sing New Kid in Town, and I wanted to come back. We're standing at the door of Blair's house in Beverly Hills, and Daniel complains that the gloves are sticking to the wires and are too tight. But he doesn't take them off because he doesn't want people to see the thin silver wires sticking out of the skin on his thumb and fingers. Blair answers the door.
"Hey, gorgeous,"
Blair exclaims. She's wearing a black leather jacket and matching pants and no shoes, and she hugs me and then looks at Daniel.
"Well, who's this?"
she asks, grinning. "This is Daniel. Daniel, this is Blair," I say. Blair offers her hand, and Daniel smiles and shakes it softly.
"Well, come on in. Merry Christmas."
There are two Christmas trees, one in the living room and one in the den, and both have twinkling dark red lights coloring them. There are people at the party from high school, most of whom I haven't seen since graduation, and they all stand next to the two huge trees. Trent, a male model I know, is there. "Hey, Clay," Trent says, a red and green plaid scarf wrapped around his neck. "Trent," I say.
"How are you, babes?"
"Great." "Trent, this is Daniel. Daniel, this is Trent." Trent offers his hand, and Daniel smiles and adjusts his sunglasses and lightly shakes it.
"Hey, Daniel,"
Trent says.
"Where do you go to school?"
"With Clay," Daniel says. "Where do you go?"
"UCLA. Or, as the Orientals like to call it, UCRA.
Trent imitates an old Japanese man, eyes slit, head bowed, front teeth stuck out in parody, and then laughs drunkenly.
"I go to the University of Spoiled Children," Blair says, still grinning, running her fingers through her long blonde hair.
"Where?" asks Daniel.
"USC, she says.
"Oh, yeah," he says. "That's right." Blair and Trent laugh, and she grabs his arm to balance herself for a moment.
"Or USC,"
she says, almost gasping.
"Or UCLA,"
Trent says, still laughing. Finally, Blair stops laughing and brushes past me to the door, telling me that I should try the punch.
"I'll get the punch," Daniel says.
"You want some, Trent?"
"No, thanks."
Trent looks at me and says, "You look pale." I notice that I do, compared to Trent's deep, dark tan and most of the other people's complexions around the room. I've been in New Hampshire for 4 months. Trent reaches into his pocket. "Here," he says, handing me a card. "This is the address of a tanning salon in Santa Monica. Now, it's not artificial lighting or anything like that, and you don't have to rub vitamin E capsules all over your bod. This thing is called an UVA bath, and what they do is they dye your skin." I stop listening to Trent after a while and look over at three boys, friends of Blair's I don't know, who go to USC, all tan and blonde, and one is singing along with the music coming out of the speakers.
"It works," Trent says.
"What works?" I ask, distracted.
"An UVA bath. UVA bath, look at the card, dude."
"Oh, yeah." I look at the card. "They dye your skin, right?"
"Right."
"Okay."
Pause.
"What have you been doing?" Trent asks. "Unpacking," I say. "What about you?"
"Well,"
he smiles proudly, I got accepted by this modeling agency, a really good one, he assures me. And guess who's going to be not only on the cover of International Mail in 2 months, but who is also the month of June in UCLA's College Man calendar? Who? I ask. Me, dude, Trent says. International Mail? Yeah. I don't like the magazine. My agent told them no nude stuff, just like Speedos and stuff like that. I don't do any nude stuff. I believe him, but don't know why, and look around the room to see if Rip, my dealer, is at the party. But I don't see him, and I turn back to Trent and ask, Yeah? What else have you been doing? Like the usual. Going to Nautilus, getting smashed, going to this Uva place. But, hey, don't tell anyone I've been there, okay? What? I said, don't tell anyone about this Uva place, okay? Trent looks worried, concerned almost, and I put my hand on his shoulder and give it a squeeze to reassure him. Oh, yeah, don't worry. Hey, he says, looking around the room. Gotta do a little business. Later. Lunch, he jokes, leaving. Daniel comes back with the punch, and it's very red and very strong, and I cough a little as I take a swallow. From where I'm standing, I can see Blair's father, who's this movie producer, and he's sitting in a corner of the den talking with this young actor I think I went to school with. Blair's father's boyfriend is also at the party. His name's Jared, and he's really young and blonde and tan and has blue eyes and incredibly straight white teeth, and he's talking to the three boys from USC. I can also see Blair's mother, who is sitting by the bar drinking a vodka gimlet, her hands shaking as she brings the drink to her mouth. Blair's friend Alana comes into the den and hugs me, and I introduce her to Daniel.
You look just like David Bowie,
Alana, who is obviously coked up out of her mind, tells Daniel.
Are you left-handed?
No, I'm afraid not, Daniel says. Alana likes guys who are left-handed, I tell Daniel.
And who look like David Bowie,
she reminds me. And who live in the colony, I finish.
Oh, Clay, you're such a beastie,
she giggles.
Clay is a total beastie,
she tells Daniel. Yes, I know, Daniel says. A beastie, totally. Have you had any punch? You should have some, I tell her.
Darling,
she says, slowly, dramatically.
I made the punch.
She laughs and then spots Jared and stops suddenly.
Oh, God, I wish Blair's father wouldn't invite Jared to these things. It makes her mother so nervous. She gets totally bombed anyway, but having him around makes it worse.
She turns to Daniel and says,
Blair's mother is an agoraphobic.
She looks back at Jared.
I mean, he's going to Death Valley next week on location. I don't see why he can't wait until then. Can you?
Alana turns to Daniel, then me. No, Daniel says solemnly. Me neither, I say, shaking my head. Alana looks down and then back at me and says,
You look kind of pale, Clay. You should go to the beach or something.
Maybe I will. I finger the card Trent gave me and then ask her if Julian is going to show up. He called me and left a message, but I can't get in touch with him, I say.
Oh, God, no, Alana says. I hear he is, like, completely fucked up.
What do you mean? I ask. Suddenly, the three boys from USC and Jared laugh loudly, in unison. Alana rolls her eyes up and looks pained.
Jared heard this stupid joke from his boyfriend who works at Morton's. What are the two biggest lies? I'll pay you back and I won't come in your mouth. I don't even get it. Oh, God, I better go help Blair. Mummy's going behind the bar. Nice to meet you, Daniel.
Yeah, you too, Daniel says. Alana walks over to Blair and her mother by the bar. Maybe I should have hummed a few bars of Let's Dance, Daniel says. Maybe you should have. Daniel smiles. Oh, Clay, you're such a total beastie. We leave after Trent and one of the boys from USC fall into the Christmas tree in the living room. Later that night, when the two of us are sitting at the end of the darkened bar at the Polo Lounge, not a whole lot is said.
I want to go back,
Daniel says quietly, with effort. Where? I ask, unsure. There's a long pause that kind of freaks me out, and Daniel finishes his drink and fingers the sunglasses he's still wearing and says, I don't know. Just back. My mother and I are sitting in a restaurant on Melrose, and she's drinking white wine and still has her sunglasses on, and she keeps touching her hair, and I keep looking at my hands, pretty sure that they're shaking. She tries to smile when she asks me what I want for Christmas. I'm surprised at how much effort it takes to raise my head up and look at her. Nothing, I say. There's a pause, and then I ask her, What do you want? She says nothing for a long time, and I look back at my hands, and she sips her wine. I don't know. I just want to have a nice Christmas. I don't say anything.
You look unhappy,
she says, real suddenly. I'm not, I tell her.
You look unhappy,
she says, more quietly this time. She touches her hair, bleached, blondish, again. You do too, I say, hoping that she won't say anything else. She doesn't say anything else until she's finished her third glass of wine and poured her fourth.
How was the party?
Okay.
How many people were there?
40, 50. I shrug. She takes a swallow of wine.
What time did you leave it?
I don't remember.
1, 2?
Must have been 1.
Oh.
She pauses again and takes another swallow. It wasn't very good, I say, looking at her.
Why?
She asks, curious. It just wasn't, I say, and look back at my hands. I'm with Trent in a yellow train that sits on Sunset. Trent's smoking and drinking a Pepsi, and I stare out the window and into the headlights of passing cars. We're waiting for Julian, who's supposed to be bringing Trent a gram. Julian is 15 minutes late, and Trent is nervous and impatient, and when I tell him that he should deal with Rip like I do instead of Julian, he just shrugs. We finally leave, and he says that we might be able to find Julian in the arcade in Westwood. But we don't find Julian at the arcade in Westwood, so Trent suggests that we go to Fatburger and eat something. He says he's hungry, that he hasn't eaten anything in a long time, mentioned something about fasting. We order and take the food to one of the booths, but I'm not too hungry, and Trent notices that there's no chili on my Fatburger. What is this? You can't eat a Fatburger without chili. I roll my eyes up at him and light a cigarette. Jesus, you're weird. Been up in fucking New Hampshire too long, he mutters. No fucking chili. I don't say anything, and notice that the walls have been painted a very bright, almost painful yellow, and under the glare of the fluorescent lights, they seem to glow. Joan Jett and the Blackhearts are on the jukebox singing Crimson and Clover. I stare at the walls and listen to the words. Crimson and Clover, over and over and over and over. I suddenly get thirsty, but I don't want to go up to the counter and order anything because there's this fat, sad-faced Japanese girl taking orders, and the security guard leaning against another yellow wall in back, eyeing everyone suspiciously. And Trent is still staring at my Fatburger with this amazed look on his face. And there's this guy in a red shirt with long, stringy hair, pretending to be playing the guitar and mouthing the words to the song in the booth next to ours. And he starts to shake his head, and his mouth opens. Crimson and clover, over and over and over. Crimson and clover. It's 2 in the morning and hot, and we're at the edge in the back room, and Trent is trying on my sunglasses, and I tell him that I want to leave. Trent tells me that we'll leave soon, a couple of minutes maybe. The music from the dance floor seems too loud, and I tense up every time the music stops and another song comes on. I lean back against the brick wall and notice that there are 2 boys embracing in a darkened corner. Trent senses I'm tense and says, What do you want me to do? You want to lewd? Is that it? He pulls out a Pez dispenser and pulls Daffy Duck's head back. I don't say anything, just keep staring at the Pez dispenser, and then he puts it away and cranes his neck.
Is that Muriel?
No, that girl's black.
Oh, you're right.
Pause. It's not a girl. I wonder how Trent can mistake a black teenage boy, not anorexic, for Muriel. But then I see that the black boy is wearing a dress. I look at Trent and tell him again that I have to leave.
Yeah, we all have to leave, he says. You said that already.
And so I stare at my shoes and Trent finds something to say.
You're too much.
I keep staring at my shoes, tempted to ask him to let me see the Pez dispenser. Trent says,
Ah, shit. Find Blair. Let's go. Let's leave.
I don't want to go back into the main room, but I realize you have to go through the main room to get back to the outside. I spot Daniel, who's talking to this really pretty tan girl who's wearing a heaven cut-off t-shirt and a black and white miniskirt, and I whisper to him that we're leaving, and he gives me this look and says, Don't give me any shit. I finally yank his arm and tell him he's really drunk, and he says no kidding. He kisses the girl on the cheek and follows us toward the door, where Blair's standing, talking to some guy from USC.
Are we leaving?
She asks.
Yeah, I say, wondering where she's been.
We walk out into the hot night and Blair asks,
Well, did we have a good time?
And nobody answers, and she looks down. Trent and Daniel are standing by Trent's BMW, and Trent's pulling the Cliff Notes to As I Lay Dying out of his glove compartment and hands them to Blair. We say goodbye and make sure Daniel can get into his car. Trent says that maybe one of us should drive Daniel home, but then agrees that it would be too much of a hassle to drive him home and then drive him back tomorrow. And I drive Blair back to her house in Beverly Hills, and she fingers the Cliff Notes but doesn't say anything except when she tries to rub the stamp off her hand. And she says,
Fuck it. I wish they didn't have to stamp my hand in black. It never comes off.
And then she mentions that even though I was gone for 4 months, I never called her. I tell her I'm sorry and turn off Hollywood Boulevard because it's too brightly lit and take Sunset and then drive onto her street and then to her driveway. We kiss and she notices that I've been gripping the steering wheel too hard and she looks at my fists and says,
Your hands are red.
Then gets out of the car. We have been in Beverly Hills shopping most of the late morning and early afternoon. My mother and my two sisters and me. My mother has spent most of this time probably at Neiman Marcus, and my sisters have gone to Jerry Magnin and have used our father's charge account to buy him and me something, and then to MGA and Camp Beverly Hills and Privilege to buy themselves something. I sit at the bar at La Scala Boutique for most of this time, bored out of my mind, smoking, drinking red wine. Finally, my mother drives up in her Mercedes and parks the car in front of La Scala and waits for me. I get up and leave some money on the counter and get in the car and lean my head up against the headrest.
She's going out with the biggest babe,
one of my sisters is saying.
Where did you go to school?
The other one asks, interested.
Harvard? What grade is he in? 9th? 1 year above her.
I heard their house is for sale,
my mother says.
I wonder if he's for sale,
the older of my two sisters, who I think is 15, mumbles, and both of them giggle from the back seat. A truck with video games strapped in the back passes by, and my sisters are driven into some sort of frenzy.
Follow that video game,
one of them commands.
Mom, do you think if I asked Dad, he'd get me a Galaga for Christmas?
The other one asks, brushing her short blonde hair. I think she's 13, maybe.
What is a Galaga?
My mother asks.
A video game,
one of them says.
You have Atari, though,
my mother says.
Atari's cheap,
she says, handing the brush to my other sister, who also has blonde hair.
I don't know,
my mother says, adjusting her sunglasses, opening the sunroof.
I'm having dinner with him tonight.
That's encouraging,
the older sister says sarcastically.
Where would we put it, though?
One of them asks.
Put what?
My mother asks back.
Galaga! Galaga!
My sisters scream.
In Clay's room, I suppose,
my mother says. I shake my head.
Bullshit! No way!
One of them yells.
Clay can't have Galaga in his room. He always locks his door. Yeah, Clay, that really pisses me off,
one of them says, a real edge in her voice.
Why do you lock your door anyway, Clay?
I don't say anything.
Why do you lock your door, Clay?
One of them, I don't know which one, asks again. I still don't say anything. I consider grabbing one of the bags from MGA or Camp Beverly Hills or a box of shoes from Privilege and flinging them out the window.
Mom, tell him to answer me. Why do you lock your door, Clay?
I turn around. Because you both stole a quarter gram of cocaine from me the last time I left my door open. That's why. My sisters don't say anything. Teenage enema nurses in bondage by a group called Killer Pussy comes on the radio. And my mother asks if we have to listen to this. And my sisters tell her to turn it up. And no one says anything else until the song's over. When we get home, my younger sister finally tells me, out by the pool,
that's bullshit. I can get my own cocaine.
The psychiatrist I see during the 4 weeks I'm back is young and has a beard and drives a 450 SL and has a house in Malibu. I'll sit in his office in Westwood with the shades drawn and my sunglasses on, smoking a cigarette, sometimes cloves, just to irritate him, sometimes crying. Sometimes I'll yell at him and he'll yell back. I tell him that I have these bizarre sexual fantasies and his interest will increase noticeably. I'll start to laugh for no reason and then feel sick. I lie to him sometimes. He'll tell me about his mistress and the repairs being done on the house in Tahoe, and I'll shut my eyes and light another cigarette, gritting my teeth. Sometimes I just get up and leave. I'm sitting at Dupar's in Studio City, waiting for Blair and Alana and Kim. They had called me and asked me to go to a movie with them, but I'd taken some Valium and had fallen asleep earlier that afternoon, and I couldn't get ready in time to meet them at the movie. So I told them I'd meet them at Dupar's. I'm sitting at a booth near a large window, and I ask the waitress for a cup of coffee, but she doesn't bring me anything, and she's already started to wipe the table next to mine and taken another table's order. But it's just as well that she doesn't bring me anything since my hands are shaking pretty badly. I light a cigarette and notice the big Christmas display above the main counter. A plastic neon-lit Santa Claus is holding a 3-foot-long styrofoam candy cane, and there are all these large green and red boxes leaning against it. And I wonder if there's anything in the boxes. I suddenly focus in on the eyes of a small, dark, intense-looking guy wearing a Universal Studios t-shirt sitting two booths across from me. He's staring at me, and I look down and take a drag, a deep one, off the cigarette. The man keeps staring at me, and all I can think is either he doesn't see me or I'm not here. I don't know why I think that. People are afraid to merge. Wonder if he's for sale. Blair suddenly kisses me on the cheek and sits down, along with Alana and Kim. Blair tells me that Muriel was hospitalized for anorexia today.
She passed out in film class, so they took her to Cedars-Sinai, which is not exactly the closest hospital to USC,
Blair says in a rush, lighting a cigarette. Kim is wearing pink sunglasses, and she also lights one, and then Alana asks for one.
You are coming to Kim's party, Clay, aren't you?
Alana asks.
Oh, yes, Clay, you've totally got to,
Kim says. When is it? I ask, knowing that Kim always throws these parties, once a week or something like that.
Sometime near the end of next week,
she tells me, though I realize that probably means tomorrow.
I don't know who to go with,
Alana says suddenly.
Oh, God, I don't know who the fuck to go with.
She pauses.
I just realized that. What about Cliff? Weren't you going with Cliff?
Asks Blair.
I'm going with Cliff,
Kim says, looking at Blair.
Oh, that's right,
Blair says.
Well, if you're going with Cliff, I'll go with Warren,
Alana says.
But I thought you were going out with Warren,
Kim says to Blair. I glance over at Blair.
I was, but I'm not going out with Warren,
Blair says, missing a beat.
You were not. You fucked. You didn't go out, Alana says. Whatever, whatever,
Blair says, flipping through her menu, glancing over at me, then away.
Did you sleep with Warren?
Kim asks Alana. Alana looks at Blair and then at Kim and then at me and says,
No, I didn't.
She looks back at Blair and then at Kim again.
Did you? No, but I thought Cliff was sleeping with Warren,
Kim says, confused for a moment.
That might be true, but I thought Cliff was sleeping with that creepy valley-turned-punk Dee Dee Hellman,
says Blair.
Oh, that is not true. Who told you that?
Alana wants to know. I realize for an instant that I might have slept with Dee Dee Hellman. I also realize that I might have slept with Warren also. I don't say anything. They probably already know.
Dee Dee did, says Blair. Didn't she tell you that? No,
Kim says.
She didn't. Me either,
Alana says.
Well, she told me,
Blair says.
Oh, what does she know? She lives in Calabasas, for God's sakes,
Alana moans. Blair thinks about it for a moment and then says slowly, evenly,
If Cliff slept with Dee Dee, then he must have slept with Raoul. Who's Raoul?
Alana and Kim ask at the same time. I open my menu and pretend to read it, wondering if I slept with Raoul. Name seems familiar.
Dee Dee's other boyfriend? She was always getting into these disgusting threesomes. They were ridiculous,
Blair says, closing her menu.
Dee Dee is ridiculous,
says Alana.
Raoul is black, isn't he?
Kim asks after a while. I haven't slept with Raoul.
Yeah, why? Because I think I met him at a backstage party at the Roxy once. I thought he OD'd. No, no, he's really cute. He's like the best-looking black guy I think I've ever seen,
Blair says. Alana and Kim nod in agreement. I close my menu.
But isn't he gay, though?
Kim asks, looking concerned.
Who, Cliff?
Blair asks.
No, Raoul. He's bi.
Bi, Blair says. And then, not too sure,
I think. I don't think he ever slept with Dee Dee, says Alana. Well, I really don't either, Blair says. Then why did she go out with him? She thought it was chic to have a black boyfriend,
Blair says, by now bored with the subject.
What a sleaze,
Alana says, shivering in mock disgust. The three of them stop talking, and then Kim says,
I had no idea Cliff slept with Raoul. Cliff has slept with everyone,
Alana says, and rolls her eyes up, and Kim and Blair laugh. Blair looks at me, and I try to smile, and then the waitress comes and takes our order. At the house in Holmby Hills, I talk to a lot of people who tell me about shopping for suits at Fred Siegel and buying tickets for concerts, and I hear Trent telling everyone about how much fun he's having at the fraternity he joined at UCLA. I also talk to Pierce, some friend from high school, and apologize for not calling him when I got in. And he tells me that it doesn't matter, and that I look pale, and that someone stole the new BMW his father bought him as a graduation present. Julian is at the party, and he doesn't look as fucked up as Alana said. Still tan, hair still blonde and short, maybe a little too thin, but otherwise looks good. Julian tells Trent that he's sorry he missed him at Carney's the other night, and that he's been really busy. And I'm standing next to Trent, who has just finished his third gin and tonic, and hear him say, It's just really fucking irresponsible of you. And I turn away, wondering if I should ask Julian what he wanted when he called and left the message. But when our eyes meet and we're about to say hello, he looks away and walks into the living room. Blair dances over to me, singing the words to Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, probably stoned out of her mind, and she says that I look happy, and that I look good, and she hands me a box from Jerry Magnan and whispers, Merry Christmas, you fox, in my ear, and kisses me. I open the box. It's a scarf. I thank her and tell her that it's really nice. She tells me to put it on and see if it fits, and I tell her that scarves usually fit all people. But she insists, and I put the scarf on, and she smiles and murmurs, "Perfect," and goes back to the bar to get a drink. I stand alone with a scarf wrapped around my neck in the corner of the living room, and then spot Rip, my dealer, and am totally relieved. Rip's wearing this thick, bulky white outfit he probably bought at Parachute, and an expensive black fedora. And Trent asks Rip, as he makes his way toward me, if he's been going parachuting.
"Going parachuting? Get it?"
Trent says, giggling. Rip just stares at Trent until Trent stops giggling. Julian comes back into the room, and I'm about to go over and say hello, but Rip grabs the scarf around my neck and pulls me into an empty room. I notice that there's no furniture in the room and begin to wonder why. Then Rip hits me lightly on the shoulder and laughs.
"How the fuck have you been?"
"Great," I say. "Why is there no furniture in here?"
"Kim's moving," he says. "Thanks for returning my phone call, you dick."
I know that Rip hasn't tried to call me, but I say,
"Sorry, I've only been back like 4 days and I don't know. But I've been looking for you." "Well, here I am. What can I do for you, dude?"
"What have you got?"
"What did you take up there?"
Rip asks, not really interested in answering me. He takes two small folded envelopes out of his pocket.
"Well, an art course and a writing course and this music course."
"Music course?" Rip interrupts, pretending to get excited.
"Did you write any music?"
"Well, yeah, a little." I reach into my back pocket for my wallet.
"Hey, I got some lyrics. Write some music. We'll make millions."
"Millions of what?"
"Are you going back?"
Rip asks, not missing a beat. I don't say anything, just stare at the half gram he's poured onto a small hand mirror.
"Or are you gonna stay and play in L.A.?"
Rip laughs and lights a cigarette. With a razor, he cuts the pile into four big lines, and then he hands me a rolled-up 20, and I lean down and do a line.
"Where?"
I ask, lifting my head up, sniffing loudly.
"Jesus," Rip says, leaning down. "To school, you jerk."
"I don't know. I suppose so."
"You suppose so."
He does both his lines, huge, long lines, and then hands me the 20.
"Yeah," I shrug, leaning back down. "Cute scarf. Real cute. Guess Blair still likes you."
Rip smiles.
"I guess," I say, doing the other long line.
You guess,"
Rip laughs. I smile and shrug again.
"It's good. How about a gram?"
"Here you go, dude."
He hands me one of the small envelopes. I give him two 50s and a 20, and he hands me the 20 back and says,
"Christmas present, okay?"
"Thanks a lot, Rip."
"Well, I think you should go back," he says, pocketing the money.
"Don't fuck off. Don't be a bum."
"Like you?"
I regret saying this. It comes out wrong.
"Like me, dude,"
Rip says, missing a beat.
"I don't know if I want to," I begin.
"What do you mean you don't know if you want to?"
"I don't know. Things aren't that different there."
Rip is getting restless, and I get the feeling that it doesn't matter a whole lot to Rip whether I stay or go.
"Listen, you've got a long vacation, don't you? A month, right?"
"Yeah, 4 weeks."
"A month, right? Think about it."
"I'll do that." Rip walks over to the window.
"Are you DJing anymore?"
I ask, lighting a cigarette.
"No way, man."
He runs his finger over the mirror and rubs it over his teeth and gums, then slips the mirror back into his pocket.
"The trust is keeping things steady for now. I might go back when I run out. Only problem is I don't think it's ever gonna run out."
He laughs. "I got this totally cool penthouse on Wilshire. It's fantastic."
"Really?"
"Yeah, you gotta stop by."
"I will."
Rip sits on the windowsill and says,
"I think Alana wants to fuck me. What do you think?"
I don't say anything. I can't understand why, since Rip doesn't look anything like David Bowie. He's not left-handed and doesn't live in the colony. Well, should I fuck her or what? I don't know, I say. Sure, why not? Rip gets off the windowsill and says, Listen, you've got to come over to the apartment. I got Temple of Doom bootleg. Cost me $400. You should come over, dude. Yeah, sure, Rip. We walk to the door. You will? Why not? When the two of us enter the living room, these two girls who I don't remember come up to me and tell me I should give them a call, and one of them reminds me about the night at the Roxy, and I tell her that there have been a lot of nights at the Roxy, and she smiles and tells me to call her anyway. I'm not sure if I have this girl's number, and just as I'm about to ask her for it, Alana walks up to me and tells me that Rip has been bothering her, and is there anything I can do about it? I tell her I don't think so. And as Alana starts to talk about Rip, I watch Rip's roommate dance with Blair next to the Christmas tree. He whispers something into her ear, and they both laugh and nod their heads. There's also this old guy with longish gray hair and a Giorgio Armani sweater and moccasins on, who wanders past Alana and me, and he begins to talk to Rip. One of the boys from USC who was at Blair's party is also here, and he looks at the old man. Guy, maybe 40, 45, and then turns to one of the girls who met me at the Roxy and makes a face. He notices me looking at him when he does this, and he smiles, and I smile back. And Alana keeps going on, and luckily someone turns the volume up, and Prince starts to scream. Alana leaves once a song she wants to dance to comes on, and this guy from USC, Griffin, comes up to me and asks if I want some champagne. I tell him sure. And he goes to the bar, and I look for a bathroom to do another line. I have to go through Kim's room to get to it, since the lock on the one downstairs is broken. And as I get to her door, Trent comes out and closes it. Use the one downstairs, he says. Why? Because Julian and Kim and Durf are fucking in there. I just stand there. Durf's here? I ask. Come with me, Trent says. I follow Trent downstairs and out of the house and over to his car. Get in, he says. I open the door and get into the BMW. What do you want? I ask him as he gets in on the driver's side. He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a small vial. A little cocaine, he says in a fake southern drawl. I don't tell him I already have some, and he takes out a gold spoon and presses the spoon into the powder, and then holds it up to his nose and does this four times. He then pushes the same tape that is on at the party into the car stereo and hands me the vial and the spoon. I do four hits also, and my eyes water, and I swallow. It's different coke than Rip's, and I wonder if he got it from Julian. It's not as good. Why don't we go to Palm Springs for a week while you're back? He suggests. Yeah, Palm Springs. Sure, I tell him. Listen, I'm going back in. I leave Trent alone in the car and walk back to the party and over toward the bar, where Griffin is standing, holding two glasses of champagne. I think it's a little flat, he says. What? I said your champagne's flat. Oh. I pause, confused for a minute. That's all right. I drink it anyway, and he pours me another glass. It's still pretty good, he says, after finishing his glass and pouring himself another. Want some more? Sure. I finish my second glass, and he pours me a third. Thanks. The girl I came with just left with that Japanese guy in the English Beat t-shirt and tight white pants. You know who he is? No. Kim's hairdresser. Wild, I say, finishing the glass of champagne and looking at Blair from across the room. Our eyes meet and she smiles and makes a face. I smile back, don't make a face. Griffin notices this and says loudly, over the din of the music, You're the guy who's going out with Blair, right? Well, used to go out with her. I thought you still were. Maybe we are, I say, pouring another glass of champagne. I don't know. She talks about you a lot. Really? Well, my voice trails off. We don't say anything for a long time. Like your scarf, Griffin says. Thanks. I drain the glass and pour myself another, and wonder what time it is and how long I've been here. The Coke is wearing off, and I'm starting to get a little drunk. Griffin takes a deep breath and says, Hey, you want to go to my house? Parents are in Rome for Christmas. Someone changes a tape, and I sigh and look at the glass of champagne he's holding, then finish my glass fast and say, Sure, why not? Griffin stands by his bedroom window, looking out into the backyard, at the pool, only wearing a pair of jockey shorts, and I'm sitting on the floor, my back leaning against his bed, bored, sober, smoking a cigarette. Griffin looks at me, and slowly, clumsily pulls off his underwear, and I notice that he doesn't have a tan line, and I begin to wonder why and almost laugh. I wake up sometime before dawn. My mouth is really dry, and it hurts to unstick my tongue from the roof of my mouth. I close my eyes tightly and try to go back to sleep, but the digital clock on the nightstand says that it's 4:30, and I only now fully realize where I am. I look over at Griffin, lying on the other side of the big double bed. I don't want to wake Griffin up, so I get out of the bed as carefully as possible and walk into the bathroom and close the door. I take a piss and then stare at myself, nude, in the mirror for a moment, and then lean against the sink and turn on the faucet and splash cold water on my face. Then I look at myself in the mirror again, this time longer. I go back into the bedroom and put my underwear on, making sure they're not Griffin's. Then I look around the room and panic because I can't find my clothes. Then I remember that it started in the living room last night, and I quietly walk down the stairs of the huge, empty mansion and into the living room. I find my clothes and dress quickly. As I'm pulling my pants up, this black maid wearing a blue robe, hair in curlers, passes by the door and glances at me for a moment, casually, as if finding some young guy, 18 or whatever, pulling up his pants in the middle of the living room at 5 in the morning was not weird. She leaves, and I have trouble finding the front door. After I do find it and leave the house, I tell myself that it really wasn't that bad last night. And I get into the car and open the glove compartment and cut a line, just to make it home. Then I drive past the gates of the house and onto Sunset. I turn the radio up, loud. The streets are totally empty, and I drive fast. I come to a red light, tempted to go through it, then stop once I see a billboard that I don't remember seeing, and I look up at it. All it says is, "Disappear here." And even though it's probably an ad for some resort, it still freaks me out a little. And I step on the gas really hard, and the car screeches as I leave the light. I put my sunglasses on, even though it's still pretty dark outside. And I keep looking into the rearview mirror, getting this strange feeling that someone's following me. I come to another red light, and that's when I realize that I forgot the scarf Blair gave me, left it at Griffin's. My house lies on Mulholland, and as I press the gate opener, I look out over the valley and watch the beginning of another day, my fifth day back. And then I pull into the circular driveway and park my car next to my mother's, which is parked next to a Ferrari that I don't recognize. I sit there and listen to the last lines of some song, and then get out of the car and walk to the front door and find my key and open it. I walk upstairs to my bedroom and lock the door and light a cigarette and turn the television on and turn the sound off. And then I walk into the closet and find the bottle of Valium that I hid beneath some cashmere sweaters. After looking at the small yellow pill with the hole in the middle of it, I decide that I don't really need it, and I put it away. I take off my clothes and look at the digital clock, the same kind of digital clock that Griffin has, and notice that I only have a few hours to sleep before I have to meet my father for lunch, so I make sure the alarm is set and I lay back, staring at the television hard, because I once heard that if you stare at the television screen for a long enough time, you can fall asleep. The alarm goes off at 11. A song called Artificial Insemination is playing on the radio, and I wait until it's over to open my eyes and get up. Sun is flooding the room through the Venetian blinds, and when I look in the mirror, it gives the impression that I have this wild, cracked grin. I walk into the closet and look at my face and body in the mirror, flex my muscles a couple of times, wonder if I should get a haircut, decide I do need a tan. Turn away and open the envelope, also hid beneath the sweaters. I cut myself 2 lines of the Coke I bought from Rip last night and do them and feel better. I'm still wearing my jockey shorts as I walk downstairs. Even though it's 11, I don't think anyone is up yet, and I notice that my mother's door is closed, probably locked. I walk outside and dive into the pool and do 20 quick laps and then get out, towel myself dry as I walk into the kitchen, take an orange from the refrigerator and peel it as I walk upstairs. I eat the orange before I get into the shower and realize that I don't have time for the waits. Then I go into my room and turn on MTV really loud and cut myself another line and then drive to meet my father for lunch. I don't like driving down Wilshire during lunch hour. There always seem to be too many cars and old people and maids waiting for buses, and I end up looking away and smoking too much and turning the radio up to full volume. Right now, nothing is moving, even though the lights are green. As I wait in the car, I look at the people in the cars next to mine. Whenever I'm on Wilshire or Sunset during lunch hour, I try to make eye contact with the driver of the car next to mine, stuck in traffic. When this doesn't happen, and it usually doesn't, I put my sunglasses back on and slowly move the car forward. As I pull onto Sunset, I pass the billboard I saw this morning that read, "Disappear Here," and I look away and kind of try to get it out of my mind. My father's offices are in Century City. I wait around for him in the large, expensively furnished reception room and hang out with the secretaries, flirting with this really pretty blonde one. It doesn't bother me that my father leaves me waiting there for 30 minutes while he's in some meeting and then asks me why I'm late. I don't really want to go out to lunch today. Would rather be at the beach or sleeping or out by the pool. But I'm pretty nice, and I smile and nod a lot and pretend to listen to all his questions about college, and I answer them pretty sincerely. And it doesn't embarrass me a whole lot that while on the way to Ma Maison, he puts the top of the 450 down and plays a Bob Seger tape, as if this was some sort of weird gesture of communication. It also doesn't really make me angry that at lunch my father talks to a lot of businessmen, people he deals with in the film industry, who stop by our table, and that I'm introduced only as my son, and the businessmen all begin to look the same, and I begin to wish that I had brought the rest of the Coke. My father looks pretty healthy if you don't look at him for too long. He's completely tan and has had a hair transplant in Palm Springs 2 weeks ago, and he has pretty much a full head of blondish hair. He also has had his face lifted. I'd gone to see him at Cedars-Sinai when he had it done, and I remember seeing his face covered with bandages and how he would keep touching them lightly. "Why aren't you having the usual?" I ask, actually interested, after we order. He smiles, showing off the caps.
"Nutritionist won't allow it."
"Oh.
How is your mother?"
he asks calmly. "She's fine."
"Is she really feeling fine?"
"Yes, she's really feeling fine." I'm tempted, for a moment, to tell him about the Ferrari parked in the driveway.
"Are you sure?"
"There's nothing to worry about."
"That's good."
He pauses.
"Is she still seeing that Dr. Crane?"
"Uh-huh."
"That's good."
There's a pause. Another businessman stops by, then leaves.
"Well, Clay, what do you want for Christmas?"
"Nothing," I say after a while.
"Do you want your subscription to Variety renewed?"
"It already is." Another pause.
"Do you need money?"
"No," I tell him, knowing that he'll slip me some later on, outside Ma Maison, maybe, or on the way back to his office.
"You look thin," he says.
"Hmm."
"And pale."
"It's the drugs," I mumble.
"I didn't quite hear that."
I look at him and say, "I've gained 5 pounds since I've been back home."
"Oh,"
he says, and pours himself a glass of white wine. Some other business guy drops by. After he leaves, my father turns to me and asks,
"Do you want to go to Palm Springs for Christmas?"
During the end of my senior year one day, I didn't go to school. Instead, I drove out to Palm Springs alone and listened to a lot of old tapes I used to like but didn't much anymore. And I stopped at a McDonald's in Sunland for a Coke and then drove out to the desert and parked in front of the old house. I didn't like the new one that the family had bought. Well, it was okay, but it wasn't like the old house. The old house was empty, and the outside looked really scummy and unkempt, and there were weeds and a television aerial that had fallen off the roof, and empty trash cans were lying on what used to be the front lawn. The pool was drained, and all these memories rushed back to me, and I had to sit down in my school uniform on the steps of the empty pool and cry. I remembered all the Friday nights driving in and the Sunday nights leaving, and afternoons spent playing cards on the chaise longues out by the pool with my grandmother. But those memories seemed faded compared to empty beer cans that were scattered all over the dead lawn and the windows that were all smashed and broken. My aunt had tried to sell the house, but I guess she got sentimental and no longer wanted to. My father had wanted to sell it and was really bitter that no one had done so. But they stopped talking about it, and the house lay between them and was never brought up anymore. I didn't go out to Palm Springs that day to look around or see the house, and I didn't go because I wanted to miss school or anything. I guess I went out there because I wanted to remember the way things were. I don't know. On the way home from lunch, I stopped by Cedar Sinai to visit Muriel, since Blair told me that she really wanted to see me. She's really pale, and so totally thin that I can make out the veins in her neck too clearly. She also has dark circles under her eyes, and the pink lipstick she's put on clashes badly with the pale white skin on her face. She's watching some exercise show on TV, and all these issues of Glamour and Vogue and Interview lie by her bed. The curtains are closed, and she asks me to open them. After I do, she puts her sunglasses on and tells me that she's having a nicotine fit, and that she's absolutely dying for a cigarette. I tell her I don't have any. She shrugs and turns the volume up on the television and laughs at the people doing the exercises. She doesn't say that much, which is just as well since I don't say much either. I leave the parking lot of Cedar Sinai and make a couple of wrong turns and end up on Santa Monica. I sigh, turn up the radio. Some little girls are singing about an earthquake in L.A. My surfboard's ready for the tidal wave. A car pulls up next to mine at the next light, and I turn my head to see who's in it. Two young guys in a Fiat, and both have short hair and bushy mustaches, and are wearing plaid short-sleeve shirts and ski vests, and one looks at me with his total look of surprise and disbelief, and he tells his friend something, and now both of them are looking at me. Smack, smack, I fell in a crack. The driver rolls down his window, and I tense up, and he asks me something, but my window's rolled up, and the top isn't down, and so I don't answer his question. But the driver asks me again, positive that I'm this certain actor. Now I'm part of the debris, the girls are squealing. The light turns green, and I drive away, but I'm in the left-hand lane, and it's a Friday afternoon nearing 5, and the traffic's bad. And when I come to another red light, the Fiat's next to me again. And these two insane fags are laughing and pointing and asking me the same fucking question over and over. I finally make an illegal left turn and come to a side street, where I park for a minute and turn the radio off, light a cigarette. Rip's supposed to meet me at Cafe Casino in Westwood, and he hasn't shown up yet. There's nothing to do in Westwood. It's too hot to walk around, and I've seen all the movies, some even twice. And so I sit under the umbrellas at Cafe Casino and drink Perrier and grapefruit juice and watch the cars roll by in the heat. Light a cigarette and stare at the Perrier bottle. Two girls, 16, 17, both with short hair, sit at the table next to mine, and I keep looking over at both of them, and they both flirt back. One's peeling an orange and the other's sipping an espresso. The one who's peeling an orange asks the other if she should put a maroon streak through her hair. The girl with the espresso takes a sip and tells her no. The other girl asks about other colors, about anthracite. The girl with the espresso takes another sip and thinks about this for a minute, and then tells her no, that it should be red. And if not red, then violet, but definitely not maroon or anthracite. I look over at her, and she looks at me, and then I look at the Perrier bottle.